Welcome to Vermont Favorites on WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM. I'm Adam Rabin, and each week I talk with makers, doers, artists, and performers about their unique journeys and what they love about living in Vermont. My guest today has appeared on stage and screen as both the President of the United States and as Vice President Al Gore. He has served up drinks on 30 Rock and made wine on Law & Order Criminal Intent. Now that he's in Vermont, he's producing short films, podcasts, TV shows, and comedy shorts, and hopefully getting some sleep. Yes? No?
Sometimes.
But for now, please welcome Vermont favorite, Lincoln L. Hayes.
Hello.
How's it going?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah, my pleasure. I've been reading up on you so much. You've been very busy for the last, 10, 15 years?
Yeah.
Yep, you started out in Colorado, northeast Colorado of all places. Whereabouts?
A tiny town called Holyoke. About 3,000 people.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you're probably probably closer to Nebraska than you are.
We have farmland in Nebraska, in fact, yeah.
Oh, far out. Yeah. And closer than Denver, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. It's a 3.5-hour drive to Denver from my parents' house.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So when I was living in New York, traveling home was tough because, you know, it's a 5-hour flight to Denver. And then another 3.5 hours in the car to the house. And it's like, yeah, and you wonder why I don't want to come home very much.
Right. Nothing really convenient.
No.
Yeah, I made that drive once from Vermont to Colorado and passed through that part.
Mm-hmm.
I remember driving through Nebraska. It was pretty, but...
Pretty flat, really, pretty boring.
Yeah. It was pretty for the first hour or two, and then it just kept going.
And you're like, I'm still in Nebraska. Ah,
You grew up in Northeast Colorado. You've been making films and videos since fifth grade.
Yeah. The first one we made was a spoof of Jurassic Park called Aw, Real Dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And this has been a trend in my educational life anyway, where they're like, oh yeah, you can make a little video if you want. And then it turns into like a half an hour short film, accidentally.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, that we meant like 10. And I was like, I'm sorry, here's the whole thing.
You get a little idea, but you just have to run with it and run with it and obsess over it.
And then the teachers are like, you're taking a lot of time out of class to make this. And I know, but it's really good. It's going to be, you're going to love it. And then they watch and they go, you think this is funny, don't you? And I'm like, yes, I think it's hilarious.
Well, they're just not they're just not your market.
No.
They're just not your target market.
Teachers were never my audience.
No, and certainly not from the fifth grade perspective.
No.
Your audience was probably other fifth graders.
Yeah, and even they were like, this is a little fatuous. We don't even know the word fatuous,
no,
but it's
fatuous.
No,
I was
going
to say fatuous. Yeah. If they said it was fatuous, then I would have been impressed, truly impressed.
I'm like, wow, that's a big word for you. Spell it. And they're like, shut up, I'm going to go play kickball.
Yeah, you're a duty head.
Exactly.
Yep. So then from there, just moving along your timeline, high school, you got into theater.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned a few things to me before we went on the air, but the one that really stuck out for me, of course, was Get Smart.
Oh, yeah.
A stage production of Get Smart. I got to hear about this.
My sophomore year, the way that it worked in my high school was, depending on who came out for the plays, determine what play they were going to do. And in my year, there were three guys who did the shows every year, my friends Adam and Dusty. And it was pretty much determined our freshman year that, okay, you three are going to be the leads in the shows. So sophomore year, it was going to be my lead, and then Adam was the lead in the musical. We only did a fall play and a spring musical. And then the next year, it was going to be Dusty is the lead and Adam is the lead, and so on and so forth. So that ended up being my year, and he picked Get Smart, and I was like, I get to perform the words of Mel Brooks. This is unbelievable.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I grew up, Mel Brooks was like my movie godfather.
Oh, yeah.
And so this was in Northeast Colorado.
This was in my high school, yeah.
Middle of nowhere.
Yep.
It's good to hear that Mel Brooks didn't just play to the coasts.
That's true. He hit the flyover states a bit.
Awesome.
But this was, you know, pre-YouTube, pre-anything. So I didn't even get to watch an episode before we did the show. So I'm just basing it off of what the older generation are telling me. So like, my parents are like, oh yeah, I remember that show. And you know, he had the shoe phone and all this cute stuff. And then I was asking other people, I was like, I've never seen it. Tell me about the show. So my performance was like fourth person
Gotcha.
Like, not even third person of like, oh yeah, it was like this. So I didn't have Don Adams' voice. I didn't, you know, have any of the shtick of the show.
Did you at least know Tennessee Tuxedo?
No, that wasn't a part of it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And the fun thing about it was we were able to add in some, you know, local jokes or some inside jokes for the school and stuff like that. So
that's great.
My high school theater director was actually one of my favorite teachers that I had because he was also the English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So he taught, you know, the literature classes and he taught AP composition. And I ended up being his TA either my junior or senior year. And then I took an independent study class with him as well. And in that class, I made it my goal to watch all 100 of the AFI top films.
Right.
Which is difficult to do in 42-minute chunks. I think
it was during class.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like his study period. So he was just, you know, grading papers or doing whatever. And I'm sitting there trying to watch Citizen Kane and make sense of it 42 minutes at a time.
That's like a week right there.
Yeah.
Of 42-minute chunks.
I didn't get very far.
No.
But he's, to this day, still one of my favorite teachers.
That's great. Yeah. I had a media teacher. I think it was like media, media education in high school. Mm. And I had a similar relationship. It was like he got that I wanted to go off and do stuff that wasn't strictly to the curriculum.
Yep.
And he was cool enough to say, you know, I might not totally get where you're coming from, but
Godspeed.
You know, go. Yeah. Yeah.
Just exactly. Be back in time for the end of class.
Yeah.
Like, cool. Can do.
Very important. And then, yeah, it always works out. And then you're still in Northern Colorado for college,
mm-hmm.
University of Northern Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And you took that short film and I guess you got a little more serious with it.
Well, I knew that I wanted to go to theater school. I didn't know. I knew that I wanted to be an actor, and I knew that I wanted to pursue that. I had looked at some California schools, and I'd looked at NYU, but they were all insanely expensive and were never going to work out. And then I started looking at the University of Northern Colorado and came to find out that it was known for three things. It was known for the nursing school. It was known for the theater school, and it was known as a teaching school. And even now, if you look at the graduates and the alumni of the college, we have a bunch of people on Broadway. We have a bunch of people touring in shows. A lot of people have done movies and TV.
While you were there, like your class, or just throughout history?
Throughout history of the school, yeah. Greg German, if you know who that actor is, he was on Ally McBeal. And he was in Talladega Nights.
Yep. Okay.
You know who exactly. He is. He went to my school.
He was the Waddle guy.
Yep. So it's lesser known people, but right. You go, oh, hey, they went to my school.
They work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, this could work out. And I had never auditioned before. It wasn't a thing we did in high school. It was just like, here, read this and stand on the stage. And if I can hear you, it's good. So I go audition for college and I don't get in. Just mm-hmm. like, no. And I auditioned for musical theater too. And come to find out, I was pretty terrible at it. I can sing and I can move, but I can't dance. And I'm not a musical theater singer, but I physically can sing. So I was like, all right, well, that didn't work out. But they had a theater studies program, which was morphed out of a general theater degree, kind of touching on everything, a little bit of all aspects of theater to get this general studies degree.
More classroom oriented.
Yeah. And, you know, you'd get a little bit of stage crew, you get a little bit of stage management, you'd get some publicity, you know, you'd get a directing class, you know, things like that. And it wasn't until my junior year that I finally got into the acting program. So then I basically had to take 4 years of the acting program into. But thankfully, I had already gotten rid of most of my gen eds the first 2 years, so I was able to just kind of fly through that program. But I also had a journalism degree that I was working on as well. So it was a double major. And within the journalism, I wanted to get into broadcasting. And the only way to be able to work at the campus radio station was to be a journalism major, or at least be declared for it. So I immediately went into the advisor's office and it's like, I want to declare a second major in JMC, in whatever will get me into that. So I declared telecommunications. And my main focus there, once I realized that the campus radio station was garbage and I didn't actually want to work at it, then my focus shifted into news writing and print. And I worked for the campus newspaper.
Oh, excellent. So even though you didn't get what you first thought you were going to get when you got to college. You didn't mm-hmm. get the acting program.
Yeah.
It seems like everything that you studied still helped you out very much ever since, the production, the directing.
Definitely.
And even the journalism,
yeah.
the promotion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't always get what you want, but you get what you need, right?
Yeah. And I really stuck with it because I knew from my sophomore year, after I had been cast in a couple shows and I gotten some really good response from people, and the almost unanimous response when people would ask if I was in the program and I would say no was surprise. They'd always be like, really? Why aren't you in the acting program? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I just wasn't a good auditioner yet or if I wasn't quite what the head of the department wanted, but it wasn't until my junior year when I was like, I'm getting into this program right now.
Yeah.
Take me.
What did you do? So how do you go from being rejected to say no?
I just kept auditioning.
Yeah.
You know, like any actor story of you just keep working at it, you keep working at it, and eventually you're going to get in. And I think it also helped that there were two other professors in that audition. And I think they were kind of like, all right, come on, he's good. Let him in. He's been in good shows. He's going to be in good shows. Let him in. Yeah. And I got into the program. But yeah, like you said, with the journalism, I thought I wanted to go into radio. And my advisor was so funny. He's like, why do you want to go into radio so much? And I was like, I love radio. And he was like, but you don't have a face for radio. And I was like, well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
It's like the most backhanded compliment.
Exactly. It's like, but you're not a chud. And I was like, well, calm down.
Yeah.
I've always...
Did you say a chud?
Yes, I did. I've always enjoyed radio, and I've always enjoyed interviewing people too as well. And I didn't even realize it at that point how much I enjoyed it until I started getting into it through the newspapers, actually. Because then I went home that summer and I worked for my hometown paper and I did feature stories. So I interviewed a lot of local people, you know, you'd call them fluff pieces, but since it's such a small town, you know, I interviewed the old music teacher who had retired however many years ago and people respected him and all that stuff. So it was that kind of stuff that I learned how to ask questions and I learned how to really listen. And then that played into the performance as well, because half of acting is listening. You have to be able to listen to what people are saying to you and really understand their meaning in order to play the proper subtext and, you know, play the emotions and all that other stuff. So they really just went hand in hand with each other. And part of the journalism was news production. We would do a mock news hour.
Of course, because it's not just knowing the theory behind how to report, but the hands-on.
How to execute it and how to be on camera and not look like, you know, a deer in headlights or some local news channel where everybody looks terrible and is not even looking at the right camera half the time. And that was fun because that was, again, both sides of the camera. I remember one exercise we did where the TA of the class liked to pick on me because he knew I was an actor. And I was floor directing that show, which is where you go to the cameras and you indicate to the on-air talent, you're over here now, we're coming over here, you give them the wrap-up signals, all that stuff. Yeah. And he was intentionally making it incredibly difficult, where he'd be like, we're switching to camera two, now to three, back to one, and we're two. And we're going to three, tell him to drag it out. And it's just making me do all of this stuff, so I'm literally bouncing between the three cameras. And then once it's over, he's just laughing in the booth.
Yeah.
I was like, thanks for that. That was a lot of fun.
There's your education right there.
Exactly. Huh? But then you put that into a real world scenario where, oh, camera two went down. We got to go to three. We got to go to one. We got to work something out. And you are running around that crazy. And it's a real thing.
And it's not until
you're prepared for it.
Yeah, you don't really learn how stuff works until you learn how it breaks.
Exactly.
And there's so many ways things can break.
Yep.
And it's all about the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I mean, you know, you walk into a studio and everything's working. Well, there's not too much to learn there. It's like it's like playing a team that's nowhere near as good as you are.
Exactly. You're like, well, this is boring. I'm not learning.
Yeah.
But that informed me how to perform on camera. So then when we had our on-camera classes for our theater, I was able to do those well. I knew how to, you know, profile myself to the camera so you could see all my face. I knew how to be aware of what my face was doing in certain moments. You know, when you're on stage, there's a distance to it. And a lot of times the focus will shift as an audience member. You'll turn your head from person to person and you're not really paying attention to someone's response as they're being spoken to. But if you're, you know, making faces or grimacing, or if you're nodding too much or, you know, indicating in any kind of weird way, you need to be aware of that.
Yeah.
And thanks to being on camera doing fake news, I was then able to translate that into acting.
Yeah, everyone that's on camera is acting, even if you don't have a line.
You never know if they're going to cut to your reaction. So you have to be present in the moment, and you have to be paying attention to what you're doing, even if you're not talking.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's move on a little bit. So you, after college, you finally made the big move to New York.
Yep.
Is that right?
I did.
Did you hang out in Colorado at all after graduation?
I moved to New Jersey first. Mm-hmm. I graduated in May of 07, and I moved to New Jersey that summer. And that was actually, you mentioned playing the president of the United States. I got that role living in New Jersey. That was a School of Visual Arts student film. And I got to play the president in that, so that was fun. It's kind of like a Logan's Run kind of riff, where once you hit a certain age, you're basically put out to pasture. I forget what the way he did it, but once I learned what Logan's Run was, I was like, oh, you just remade Logan's Run.
Yeah. So was this a school you were going to? Or
no. I'd submitted for the role, and I got cast for the part.
Gotcha.
And then in spring of 08, I moved into Queens and then started living and working in New York then.
And making it happen, right?
Slowly but surely, yeah.
Yeah.
Doing mostly theater to start. I got a first role that ended up being in the Midtown International Theater Festival, which was pretty cool. A role that I was too old for, but that happens. And was doing...
Well, geez, you must have been pretty young at the time anyway.
So. Yeah, but I was supposed to be like 17, and I was 22 or 23 with a full beard.
Well.
So that always makes me look too old.
Yeah.
But yeah, then I started...
You mean you didn't shave for the, didn't shave your beard for the part?
I did, but I looked ridiculous. I don't look good without a beard. You can ask my wife. She's always like, no, beard. No.
That's funny.
Always beard.
Yeah. It goes both ways. I've had a beard and I look at pictures of myself with the beard and I'm just like, no, I don't know. It just looks like I have hair that belongs on a different part of my body on my face.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I can't do this. The mistake I made, of course, was after having a beard for 2 years, shaving it off in the middle of January in Vermont and then walking outside it was like
my ice face.
Yeah.
my poor face.
It was like doing a dive onto a bed of nails.
Yeah.
But that's my problem, not yours. So you shaved your beard for the role. That's commitment for you.
Yep.
And then you eventually worked your way up. I'll tell you what, before we get into the next big step, when you start making some really big leaps professionally, every week I like to ask my guest to tell me four of their favorite things about Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I'm going to ask you about is, who is your favorite Vermonter?
Well, that was the easiest question.
Yeah.
And that is my wife, Rachel. She is from Essex Junction. She went to school out at Hofstra on Long Island, and then after graduation moved into the city. Where we met, and she opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. I was drinking a lot of really cheap beer before we met. And then she's like, no, welcome to Vermont beer.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's why you need a Vermonter in your life, if nothing else, then to get you off.
And she's like, no, Cabot cheese. No, real maple syrup. And I went from, like 155 pounds to 180 pounds. So thanks for that, wife.
Yeah, well, they're good at that also. Yeah. You get the right Vermont influence, you start drinking the good beer.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about beers a little later.
Yeah.
No doubt we got plenty to talk about there. But you met Rachel in New York.
Yeah. We met at a mutual friend's birthday in a gay bar.
Yeah.
I had just done a play. It was a Molière play, but it was one of the biggest train wrecks I've ever been a part of in my life. The girl who was producing /directing/starring in the show was doing the show because she was moving to LA and she just wanted to do a play before she left, which I would have said the same thing.
What was the challenge? What was the challenge with Molière?
She didn't know what she was doing.
Oh, well, that's a challenge.
Yeah. She had no idea how to direct. She had no idea how to direct people to understand the comedy of it.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of inexperienced actors just talking.
The comedy is not always slapstick. It's not always immediately apparent on the page.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to read it and like kind of act it out in your head to see the situational.
Read it on the page and you're like, oh, is there a joke in this? And then you put it on its feet and you see it in context and you go, oh, there it is. Okay. Yeah. The joke is that my character doesn't get the joke.
Right.
Got it. Now I know how to play it. But that show was so bad, I told all of my friends not to come see it. And it was on a Monday night, and we had one performance. And I was like, oof.
Yeah.
And once
it was
over.
A good thing that it was on a Monday night.
Yeah, because then nobody went.
Yeah.
But it was so bad, and I hadn't planned to go to the birthday, because I wasn't sure that I would know anybody. But then after the show, I was like, I need a drink. It was like, even if I don't know a single person there, I'm going to go drink some whiskey, and I'm going to forget this play ever happened. And I walk in, and I see Thomas there, and I go up and I say hello to him, and then this...
Thomas is
the mutual friend.
Oh, okay.
And this 5'3" brunette just slides right up next to him, puts her arm around him, and normally I wouldn't comment on appearance or say anything like that, but the first thing that I said to her was, "You are petite." And she said, "Yes, I'm pocket-sized." Oh, and I was like, uh-oh, here we go.
Yeah, you, yeah.
And that was that.
And it worked.
Yeah, that worked.
You're small. Let's get married.
Yeah. I told her that at one point I said I didn't have a lot of money, but I did have a Metro card, so I could at least get her home on the subway. She thought that was pretty good.
That's a good line.
And,
I got to remember that one.
Yeah. Her roommate grabbed her at one point and was like, "Oh, we need to go. There's a cab outside." So I was going to walk her out. But then the bartender thought I was walking out of my check. So he's like, "Whoa, whoa, come back. And I was like, "All right, hang on. Go back, pay for my check, turn around. She's already gone." She finds me on Facebook because we had so many mutual friends. And she gives me her number. And then we ended up texting till 4:30 that morning.
Wow, first night.
Yeah.
So yeah, love at first sight, huh?
Yep, as gross as that is.
Yeah, well, I kind of fell into the same situation.
You know, it's great, isn't it? And you're always like, this isn't real. Who's punking me?
Right. You doubt it for like a couple weeks, a couple months, and mm-hmm. then you're like, oh, this is awesome.
Yep.
And you just run with it. That's great. But you weren't ready to run from New York just yet. You did some pretty cool gigs while you were still there.
Mm-hmm.
30 Rock?
Yes, twice.
Oh, twice.
Yes.
I knew
first,
you were on it.
The first one was insignificant, and I'm the only one who knows. I'm very, very far in the background, but... I saw Tina Fey from afar, and I was like, I'm working on 30 Rock. This is so cool.
Did you have lines on that first episode?
Nope. No. Just, I'm not sure I was in the union yet at that point. So I was just like the background, way back there. But then the second time I got to work on it was actually the second to last episode of the series. And it's a cutaway scene with Kristen Schaal where she's being... found out by an undercover private detective with a hidden camera on, named Shy Ronnie, I think, or I forget what his name was, but I play the bartender in the scene. Didn't have any lines, and on action, I just clear the scene or walk out of the scene. But in between shots, I made Kristen Schaal laugh, and I was like, mission accomplished.
You win. Did
it. All right, everybody, I'm going to go. Good luck with the rest of this television program.
I'm
going
to retire now. And yeah,
but it was it was so fun to be there. And I think it might've been second unit. So like not all the principals were there, and it was a very small crew. The way that they shot it, they just shot it on like a DSLR camera, but he held it about chest level. So it looked like it was a hidden camera, and we were occupying, I think what is the TGS stage. So they built like three sets within this one thing. So if you look to the right, it was the bar set. And if you look to the left, there's footage later in the episode where she's being interrogated or she's giving a deposition. Mm. And it's like a conference table, but it was all within the same room. So they shot all that and they shot all that and they shot something else and shot something else. And then we were done. But I was just like, I'm in Silver Cup Studios. This is where they make 30 Rock.
That's great, because it sounds like if you had blinked, you would have missed it.
Oh, yeah. But it's one of those that when I watch the episode with people, I go, and that's me. And that's it.
But it sounds like you had the presence of mind on that day to know where you were revel
in that.
That's so important also.
And knowing that the show was coming to an end and it was one of my favorite shows, I was like, I'm going to milk every second of this.
Yeah. I know I saw the episode. I've seen every episode when it came on the air. I'm trying to remember. I remember Kristen Schaal was... excellent in those, toward the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. You also had a gig, Law and Order, one of the many Law and Orders.
Mm-hmm. That was very early on. That was my first.
So was that before 30 Rock?
That 30 Rock would have been then. I want to say like 2011 or 2012, and Law and Order would have been 2010. I wasn't in the union yet. I got a waiver, which means that they pay you like your union for the day. And if you get three waivers, you are eligible to join the union. It's very expensive to join. It's very difficult to join.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, waiver. And I was working at the restaurant, and one of the people who worked in the office, I forget what his title was, but he kind of was like a publicity kind of marketing guy. And he came to me and he goes, oh, hey, would you want to work on Law and Order? And I was like, yeah.
He's yeah, like, that's the answer.
He's like, well, I have more. I was like, yes. What else? Yes, I would.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, because they're going to film an episode here and they want somebody, they want a few people who work here to be in the episode to play like they work here. And I was like, yes, I will be there. Of course.
I would imagine that any restaurateur in New York
yeah.
has several actors on staff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We were
so it's
all
pretty safe bet.
Actors, musicians, and writers.
Excellent.
So I was just in the background again, and my scene was actually cut from the episode. But I did watch the episode, and, you know, I was in the same room with Vincent D'Onofrio, and he's a giant man and super intimidating and super intense. And that was one of my first experiences being that close to the principal characters and that close to like the director and the camera. 'Cause everything else I had done had been, you know, crowd scenes and, you know, high school dances and stuff like that, or like just walking by on the street. But that was one of the first times that I got to like listen to what they were saying and pick up on some of the lingo that they use and things like that.
Really,
and was like, oh, okay, so what do we call this light? What do you call this? What is the martini shot? Like all of these different lingos that they use in the industry. Huh. That was my first exposure to it. And I was like, I want more. Give me all of this.
Yeah, it's so, well, I hate to bring you down, but how did it feel to have your scene cut?
Oh, it was devastating.
Yeah. Did you not know until it aired?
No. Oh. And like, I feel like the hometown newspaper had done like a little article about it, and everybody was really excited, and they're like, oh, when's your episode going to air? It's like, I think it's going to air this day, but I don't know. And then it didn't air, and something else aired in its place, and it got moved. And it was like this 2 or 3 week thing of like, I don't know, guys, I promise. I think it's going to happen. And then I'm not even in the episode. And I was like, well, that was for naught.
Yeah. A little,
but it was a really great working experience. And that was one of many leading up to getting into the union. And I got to work on Boardwalk Empire, Deception, which got canceled, Lipstick Jungle, which got canceled. I worked on Spider-Man 2, Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
So many things that I've forgotten all of them.
That's
I got to work on Smash a couple times. That was really fun. All these different projects that were like, this is what's happening in New York right now. So to be on those sets and to be working on them was really cool, because then when they did air, my phone would blow up and be like, did I just see you on Smash? And I'd be like, I think so.
Probably.
Let me go home and watch it.
Excellent. So you're being on the set all these times with all these different kinds of shows, not just one show over and over again. And I would imagine all that behind the scenes witnessing, because when you're an extra or you have a small part, you're not trying to remember, you know, a dozen lines that
right.
they have to say. You don't have to think too much about your blocking.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what's going on around you. And
yep.
I would imagine that you were taking in just as much about acting as you were about the production side.
Oh, definitely. You're also observing how the principal actors on the show behave, how they're interacting with the crew, how they're interacting with their assistants, how they're interacting with the director, the director's relationship to the cast and crew, the second director, the assistant director, the second, all of these different positions and all of their different roles, and how it all fits together to make a cohesive project. And it's fascinating. It's the most educational aspect of acting that I've had since college, of just being able to observe it. And then they say places, and then you get to your mark, and then you do your thing. And I was never one of the extras that was like, give me a line, give me more screen time. I was, okay, you gave me a movement, you gave me a task to do, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do it the exact same every single time. I'm going to make it exactly what you want, and I'm not going to draw attention to myself unless you want me to.
Right.
Prime example of that was I got to do a day on Inside Amy Schumer, and we're shooting a scene in a pharmacy. And the whole joke of that particular sketch was that she just kept buying rounds for people to make them like her. So she's out at the bar with her friends and they're ignoring her. So she's like, round of drinks on me. And they're like, yay, Amy rules. So then she goes into the pharmacy and there's a line of people behind her and they're all annoyed that she's taking so long. So she says, a round of pills for everybody. And I'm standing maybe 6 feet away from a camera up on a ladder and it's shooting down this aisle and I'm looking at cough medicine. Just, and he's like, just look around, you know, all the stuff. And then she's going to say the line and then be excited. Be really, really excited. And I was like, okay. So she says the line and I throw my head back. I throw my fists up in the air and I go, yes. And I was just like, oh God, that was way too big. They're going to hate that. Yeah. So that was take one. Take two. They do it again. And I go, yay. And I'm just, you know, half of that.
Right.
They yell cut. Either the second or one of the directors comes over and goes, bigger, bigger, like you did the first time. Make that way bigger.
Well, that's inside, like, Amy Schumer. Okay. You know, it's not a subtle kind of show.
It needed to be big. And then they ended up going with that first one where I'm just like,
you can't beat the first take.
And I have a screenshot of it that I immediately got out my phone and took a picture of the TV. And I was like, that's me.
Oh, I love it. So what I was getting at with all your on-the-job training is, in front and behind, you started doing your own productions there.
Yep.
And the one that I wrote down, I watched a few episodes of it, is the Boyfriend Training series on YouTube, which ironically, or fittingly, I should say, fittingly, you worked on with your then girlfriend.
Well, by the time we actually shot it, we were married.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had it written, and we were going to get it shot before we got married, and then time got away from us, life got away from us. And we ended up shooting it that October, and we got married in September. So by the time the show was running, I was a husband giving boyfriend training. Wow. And we did the first season that October, and she directed it, and we had a crew of two. And it was really fun. We shot at green screen. I had to learn how to do green screen. I was working at a production studio that had a green screen, but we hadn't really utilized it at all yet. So I had to learn how to light it, which is different than anything else.
Green screen lighting is very particular.
I had to learn the nuances of sound and all of that other stuff. So I was basically like, I'm going to take on this incredibly difficult project for fun. But thankfully each episode was only 3 minutes at most. And I did six of them. And then the studio was great enough to produce the show for me. So I was actually able to learn how to do the green screen at work while working on that project and doing my regular job. And they really liked the outcome. And I had enough ideas written that when it came time to do the six episodes, I was like, well, I have at least six more. And I think I had like eight or nine more. And then we did a second season the following April. And I learned enough doing it the first time that we did the lighting better. I had upgraded my editing software, so I was able to make the post-production look that much crisper and that much cleaner, and it was just a vast improvement from the first season.
Yeah, well, it's great that, you know, you'd hate, especially if you're just doing something for fun, and that there's not like some kind of budget limit or constraints, that, you know, if you're just doing it for fun, the least you can get out of it, in addition to the fun, of course, is that you're learning or that you're growing.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Lincoln L. Hayes, a local performer and producer on Vermont Favorites, a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM. Let's move on to the big leap to Vermont, right? So you're in New York, you're doing these productions, 30 Rock, Law and Order, and a few other oddball projects on the side. What drew you away from the big city?
We were coming to the end of our lease. We were living in South Harlem, and our lease was up. And we had just gotten married. At the time, neither of us were really doing anything that we were passionate about. We had day jobs and we're working on the random odd project here and there, but we were just kind of burnt out on the business and living in New York. So we looked around for different places to live. We thought about, you know, making big leaps like California, going to some of the smaller cities for production like Atlanta or Austin or even Chicago or Minneapolis, Vancouver, and ultimately decided that we just kind of wanted to take a break from all of it. And we said, all right, well, where would we want to live? And Vermont came onto the list.
Well, that's where she's from.
It's where she's from. We have friends here. A lot of her friends from high school still live here. One of her best friends had just relocated here with her family. Her other friend was contemplating a move back from Boston. And we said, you know what, let's give it a shot. There's theater up here. There's, you know, a comedy scene that we found out once we arrived. And let's just go and have a yard and a car and, you know, some space.
Yeah.
So we made the move up here in 2015. And it was difficult at first, but we found a very welcoming community within the comedy club, the Vermont Comedy Club. My wife started taking improv classes, met who are now her improv team, Slinky Says Relax, and kind of just took off from there. I learned about the wonderful resources that are available here at VCAM. I remember my orientation. I came in on for the Saturday orientation, and it was me, another guy, and a 17-year-old kid who was thinking about going into video maybe in college. And just sitting there listening to all of the services that were available for free, my jaw was just on the floor because I was like, what?
It really is amazing what we have here.
This is free. Because the biggest hang-up producing stuff in New York is finding the equipment and finding the people. So, okay, I can find a camera. I don't know how to use it. Need somebody to run the camera. I can get somebody to do sound. I don't know how to do that. But we also need this. Who has that? And it was just this constant battle of who's available next Tuesday to help me with this thing. We come to Vermont, and it's like, oh, I have a studio that I can use.
Yeah, and it seems like you found a team pretty quickly. I know the Slinky Says Relax. I was actually taking improv classes.
That's right.
The first few levels. I dropped out. I'm an improv dropout. Total
so
improv dropout.
Don't feel bad.
Yeah, I'm over it now.
Yeah.
but yeah, I've known Adam Wood for ages, and you know I met the other guys and women in that. But you also met someone that you work on a show with.
That's right.
David Metzger. Am I saying that right?
Metzger.
Metzger.
Yeah.
He, I saw a film that he produced several years ago with Natalie Miller from the Vermont Comedy Club. But before we get into that, a thought that I had was VCAM is a great illustration of how in Vermont there is this great capacity, great ability and encouragement to produce things. But at the same time, we're Yankees. You have to do it yourself. You have to make the opportunity. And you totally jumped on that. So even though you're not from around here.
Oh yeah.
You are a Flatlander. You got the aesthetic, the you know, the mode of operation up here is you can do whatever you want, but you actually have to do it.
Yep. And I was that guy who came in and I was like, "Hi, I'm new in town. I want to make a TV show. I want to make this. I want to make that. I have a list in my phone of project ideas. And anytime my wife and I go out for drinks or whatever, we're like, do you want to have a production meeting? And we just go through the list and like, we can make this next or we can make that. Or she has ideas and we write them down and we brainstorm different ways to do stuff.
It's great that you work with your wife at that level. And it's also great that, you know, you go out for dinner anyway. If you talk about business, you keep the receipt, you can write it off.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Exactly.
So what is it? How has it been? I mean, I know the answer to this. Working with Rachel on projects.
It's very rewarding. It has its own challenges, but it's ultimately very, very rewarding because we know what we find funny, and we know, since we consume so much media, we watch a ton of movies, we watch TV shows, we watch all the Netflix and all the Hulu, all that stuff. We know what people are watching because we're watching it too. So our goal with Pretty Beard Productions is to just make stuff that we would want to watch and hope that other people want to watch it too. We're also using it as vehicles for ourselves as performers, but also as writers and directors and producers and, you know, taking on as many of these roles as we can to get a feel for it, to see what's the best fit for us.
Yeah. The challenge might also be that you enjoy working with your wife, obviously, because you know you guys are in love, to not let that make things seem rosier than they are. You still have to be critical. You still have to say, okay, you know what, husband or wife, that didn't work. Or we've
had those moments on a few of the projects where she tends to get concerned about things that I'm not thinking about, like we were working on a project and she was very concerned that we were keeping our extras too long. And I was like, we've been here for an hour. We had this slated until like 2 o'clock and it's 11:30. Just, they're fine. And you look over and they're talking and they're having fun. And they're like, they've never made a movie before. So this is really exciting for them. She's like, I know, I just feel like we're wasting their time. And I was like, this is movie making. Half of it is sitting around and waiting. You know that.
Yeah.
So that's been the biggest trouble. She becomes a taskmaster on set for the most part of, you know, we need to do this. It's this time. We should take a break, that kind of stuff. So she's great about that. And until we have a project that I'm not acting in, that's the role that I definitely need her to fill. But yeah, she's usually, you know, the lead female in the project as well. So she's got her own acting stuff that she needs to worry about, yeah, in addition to being the police producer and making sure that I'm staying on track.
One of the coolest things I saw on your website, LincolnLHayes.com,
mm-hmm,
is what Kent did, which is a short film that I guess you both produced,
mm-hmm,
and that Rachel stars in, and, well, you co-star, mm-hmm, with her. And then what other roles were you? Were you the, you know, producers, editors?
Yes. I produced, directed, edited, and starred in it.
And it's very different from the other things, mm-hmm, we talked about, you know, the comedy, the broad comedy,
yep,
the, you know, even the sudden, more subtle comedy, because that was a dark little like five.
That was our first foray into drama. Yeah. It was about an 8-minute film. We were like, all right, let's try something different. And that was one of the first scripts that I've ever written that she immediately liked on the first draft.
Hmm.
To the point where I had written it and I was kind of sitting on it for a minute and I was like, well, I have this script. What do you think about it? And we read it in bed and she didn't stop talking about it for 45 minutes. Just
excellent.
Like, she just loved it. She thought it was so like nuanced and dark. She's like, oh, and I love that this is this and oh, it's this. And it's like, yes, all of, yeah, those things. Absolutely.
What struck me is that you used a very particular technique with the short film genre, which is you didn't try to tell the full 2-hour story,
mm-hmm,
of a feature film. You said, we're not telling you how we got here. And we're not exactly telling you what happens after the end, after the credits roll.
Right.
But this is the key moment in a story. And,
mm-hmm,
that's really what storytelling is about. It's,
yeah,
about the moment of conflict, the moment of truth.
Right.
And I'd just like to hear more about how do you let go of the need to tell a beginning, middle, and end in a story and really embrace that short film or sketch sometimes?
Yeah. For the most part, I always say that we work within the budget, which is nothing. So we always try to shoot something we know we can shoot. And even that was a stretch for us. We ended up, you know, utilizing a local restaurant, getting more equipment than we'd ever used, using more actors than we'd ever used for a longer period of time. Previous short that we did, Pillow Talk, has a cast of, I think, 13. But each little vignette was such that, like, I call somebody at 8, then I call somebody at 8:30, and then I call somebody at 9. We shoot that one, then they're gone. They shoot that one, then they're gone. Whereas what Kent did, we had people in the restaurant for several hours and we were working together for that amount of time.
Yeah.
And with that one, I just kind of had an idea of a crime short where a guy has to go face his boss after he's had a colossal mistake.
Yeah.
And then how does he rectify that? How does he make it up to her? And then, without dragging it out and making it more than it was, I was like, and this is how it ends.
Huh.
And the title came out of the story itself, Kent did. So many people after the fact go, well, yeah, but what did he do? And I'm like, that's for you to figure out. That's the mystery. We don't know what he did. The only people who know what he did are the characters in the film.
And it's not terribly important because it's about the characters. It's like people asking, what is that thing that's lit up inside Vincent Vega's suitcase?
Exactly.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know,
it could be that. You put whatever into that suitcase that you need to put in that suitcase for it to make sense for you.
Yeah.
So whatever Kent did was bad enough that the other crime family was mad about it, that Katerina was furious about it, and that ultimately what happens at the end of the film is the necessary and logical conclusion to that story.
No doubt. And correct me if I'm wrong, you worked with David Metzger on that?
Yes. We've worked with David now since a video we did called The People for the Ethical Treatment of Rancors, which is a PETA spoof featuring creatures from Star Wars. And we were hooked up with him thanks to Nathan Hartswick from the Comedy Club. And he's like, oh, you guys do this film and sketch stuff. David's a filmmaker. You guys should work together. Mm-hmm. So we hired him for that project. And then after that and the success thereof, because that actually got featured on Nerdist.com, which was pretty great.
That's very great.
After that, he was like, yeah, you guys don't need to pay me anymore. Let's just work together. So he shot what Kent did. He shot Dinnergate. He shot The People for the Ethical Treatment of Direwolves, which is the same characters, but
Game
now
of Thrones.
For Game of Thrones. Yeah. We have several more of those lined up, by the way. I'm looking forward to making those.
Those cracked me up. I watched the Direwolves one, and I don't even know Game of Thrones. I mean, I know it like tangentially, but mm-hmm. I know PETA,
yeah.
Right? And I know the Vermont, you know, that Bleeding Heart
yep.
movement that I can't completely say I'm not a part of.
Exactly.
And I was like, okay, I get it. Sometimes that's the best, in my opinion, it's always been the best form of humor is mm-hmm. when you can make fun of yourself.
Exactly.
You can find a little spot in yourself that you can just say, yeah, this is a little much for some people and mm-hmm. I get it.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And well, then, we ended up, coming up with the idea for Vermont Film Essentials, our television show.
Cool. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I got to ask you about, let's do another Vermont favorite. Mm-hmm. I'll ask you about your favorite Vermont memory.
Ooh, favorite Vermont memory would have to be the Vermont International Film Festival in 2015. We submitted Pillow Talk on a whim. It was a free submission, and we said, oh, well, let's see how this goes. The only stipulation was that you had to be a Vermonter. And I was like, well, Rachel's a Vermonter. We live in Vermont now. Let's do it.
They're not going to check your birth certificate
exactly.
or anything, right?
There's not a birther movement at the festival.
No.
And we submitted it, and there were some really, really great films, you know, of varying lengths, animation, you know, kind of like home movie kind of things. And it was really fun, and it was really cool to be a part of it. And then we ended up winning 3 awards.
Wow.
And I was just like, what? What?
Well,
really?
What were they? What were the 3?
We won screenwriting, which was surprise. I was like, oh my God, thank you. Cause yeah. I wrote that one on my own. Rachel and I came up with the story, and a lot of the incidents in it were from her life, but I wrote that script, and I was like, thank you so much. Excuse me. And then, we ended up winning the Goldstone Award, which was a cash prize. Ooh. And one of the more prestigious awards of the festival.
Yeah.
So I guess it was only the 2 awards for that one. But it was just like, you know, here we are, brand new in town. We live here 4 months and we're already being recognized for our work. And it was just like, this is amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, what's your favorite Vermont place?
Hmm.
Now that you've been here a couple of years.
I would have to say probably Woodstock. We went down there for just a weekend trip and just had a really, really wonderful time. It was in the winter, so it was freezing cold, but I'm very much looking forward to going down, not in the winter. Maybe we'll go down there for foliage and check stuff out, but just some of my best memories are the days where we're like, let's just drive somewhere. And now that we have a car, you know, like normal people.
Right. Not like New Yorkers.
Exactly. And since it's a Prius, I don't feel bad about driving everywhere.
Wow. That's a startling coincidence. Mm-hmm. I've been here. I moved here in 99, and about a year, actually coming up on 2 years ago, my wife and I, we started doing the Vermont 251 Club. I don't know if you're familiar with mm-hmm. it. It's kind of an unofficial club of people who just travel around the whole state visiting each of the 251 cities and towns.
Cool.
Yeah. And, you know, there's like, you go to the website, there's a checklist.
Oh,
and,
neat.
Yeah, I think we've been to Woodstock. I'll have to check my checklist. So let's talk about what you are doing here at the station. I probably should have put that disclaimer up at the front that you also,
yeah.
I know, that you're also, you do production here in the same studio, where the same building mm-hmm. at the Media Factory.
Yeah.
You're doing 2 things actually related that are similar. One is the show on, what is it, on Channel 17?
15,
sorry. Mm-hmm. Which is Vermont Film Essentials.
Right.
With Dave Metzger.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
That was originally going to be a radio show on this very station.
Yeah.
And our idea was that we were going to just talk about classic cinema because it really is a movie education class for me, and David is the professor. So he curates the schedule and picks all these great films that he thinks that I would enjoy or that I should see. So that's how we pitched it. And the idea was that we were going to just get a couple cameras and set them up in the studio and kind of just make it a web show. And Bill Simmon was like, well, why don't you just shoot it in the studio and make it a TV show and put it out on the channel and on the radio? And we're like, Bill, yeah. You are a genius.
Yeah.
And then it evolved to being shot in black and white and us wearing suits.
Yeah.
And my whole excuse to wear the suits was, I don't have any excuse to dress up anymore. So once a week, I get to wear a suit.
Yeah.
And David's like, I'm fine with that. I was like, yes.
That's impressive because Vermont, the whole dressing up in Vermont thing, it's not really a thing.
It's not a thing. And as much as I want to just, you know, wear flannel and Merrells and all that kind of stuff,
it works.
Sometimes I just want to put on a pair of dress shoes and some slacks.
Yeah. The one episode I started watching, I was like, they're dressed up. I was like, okay, I get it. You know, it's black and white and you're talking about films. And then the episode I tuned into was when you were talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And what you said about the professor, about David being the professor and you being a bit, you know, skeptical. When you started trashing on 2001, I was like, oh, Lincoln, you're going to get it.
And I still don't like that movie, but I respect it. Respect it, but I don't enjoy watching
it. We'll have to settle for that.
Yep.
Yeah. But you're also doing another film. You're doing a podcast with
Tim Bridge. He's a local comedian and improviser.
Yeah.
That actually is the evolution of a podcast that I've been doing since 2011. Back then it was called the WTF Are You Watching podcast. And I was doing it with my best friend, Kyle Anderson, out in LA. And we were doing it via Skype. And we would find the worst movies on Netflix and make fun of them. And we did that for a few years before we were like, I can't watch this anymore. Let's watch better things.
Yeah.
So then it kind of evolved to films that he's always wanted to see, films that I always wanted to see. Oh, I saw this. Let's watch that. Or we started getting more guests on and they would recommend films that were way out of our purview. And that was incredibly fun. And we continued to do that into the move here, but then it just got increasingly difficult to schedule all the time with each other because he had changed jobs and had a different schedule as well. So we decided, all right, once we hit 200, let's stop the show. And around that time, the Comedy Club was going to be opening, and I pitched the show to the Comedy Club, rebranding it the What the Hell Are You Watching podcast, because I was like, that could probably go on posters better.
Yeah.
And I pitched it to them as a monthly show with a local comedian as my co-host, and then we would either have the headlining comedian as our guest or a local performer come on and do the show with us that way. So Kyle and I finished at 200. Tim and I then started that fall of 2015, and it's had a rocky start. We started at the club. We weren't able to continue with the club, so then we moved into my house again. But since then, we've done a live show at the club. In the classroom, which has worked out great. And the show itself has evolved too, to where now we are watching new releases and things that are in theaters so that when the episodes come out, the films are still in the zeitgeist.
It's almost like a topical.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a little more in the now.
And you're up to how many episodes on that?
We just recorded the 100, his and my 41st episode.
See, this is what I've definitely been wanting to talk to you about, because you're my third interview. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking ahead. I was like, oh my God, he's got 200. He did 200 of that one. He's up to 41 of this one. And then a couple other people I'm talking to, a couple other podcasts, local podcasts, I'm looking into seeing if they want to get involved with WPTV. They're up to like 100 and this and that.
Yep.
How do you keep yourself engaged in something that, and I might be answering the question for you, where there isn't that money involved, you know, there isn't, you know, the professional opportunity.
Yeah. It's passion. You just have to want to do it. Yeah. And I like doing the podcast. It's fun. It's fun to sit with Tim and BS and, you know, take apart movies and tell each other that we're wrong. And it's really fun to have guests come in and have the dynamic change. And it, one of my favorite things that we've done with the show so far is our friend Brian Park came on the show. And I know Brian through the comedy club, and we were in improv classes together. And he's a fan of the podcast, which is also a weird thing to have fans of you. And you're like, but we're friends. This is weird.
Yeah.
But just to have him come on the podcast and to see him be so excited just to be in the room with us. It's like, we're just sitting
We're just two guys sitting around.
But as a fan of podcasts, I have that rush too. Like if I could go be on the Never Not Funny podcast, Jimmy Pardo's podcast, I would lose my mind. And it would be less than what we're doing right now, which is two guys sitting in a room talking into microphones. And nobody's listening to you in that moment, but the idea that people will is just like, oh, it's so titillating.
It's alive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to reflect on that for a little while because it is, I'm right at the beginning of something, and I'm trying to figure out, and I can't figure out. I don't know where this is going, but I know I like talking.
Well, you're only three in.
Right. Exactly.
Give yourself a break, man.
Yeah. Well, I don't do that.
Yeah. I had a podcast called the Riding Your Coattails podcast that I did. I want to say I got maybe 25 or 30 episodes in, and then I couldn't find anybody to be my guest anymore. But the whole conceit of it was interviewing people who are pursuing their passions, and that I will ride your coattails to success through this podcast. And it was just so strange to me that like I was constantly trying to reach out to people to get them on the podcast, and podcasting wasn't really big at the point. Mm. So they weren't interested. So then I stopped doing the show because it's like, it's just getting too hard to get anybody to talk to.
Right.
And now I feel like I could very easily reboot that show. And just within Burlington itself, I could make 100 episodes. Just because there's so many people here who are doing interesting things that, hey, let me talk to you for 45 minutes about stand-up comedy. Let me talk to you for half an hour about improv or music or pottery or yoga or any number of things that so many people that I know here do on the side or for fun or, oh, yeah, it's my third job kind of thing. It's like, Well, that's the one that you're the most passionate
exactly.
about.
Exactly, yeah. The one person that I spoke to on Sunday a few days ago, yeah, it was that same thing. You know, the art was his third job, but that's the one that interests me. You know, I'm listening to you saying you want to bring this podcast back, and I'm debating between encouraging you and hijacking you.
Yeah.
Because it's very similar to what I'm hoping to do. Because, yeah, you're right. There are so many people for such a small town. And the density of artists and producers, people who are making stuff, is staggering. So, yeah, I guess it's kind of encouraging. I'm not going to run out of people anytime soon.
I mean, you could walk through the halls of this building alone and you have half a dozen people that you could interview about what they do here, let alone what they do outside of this place.
Awesome. Well, let's go on to the final favorite Vermont question, your favorite Vermont food. And you gave me a ton of answers, so I don't know how you want to break it down.
I haven't had a dearth of favorite foods living here in Vermont. The cheese is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
Cheese and beer. Yeah, those are why I'm fat.
Yeah. You're not fat by Vermont standards. You're just getting up to Vermont weight. You're getting up to your Vermont weight.
I need to get down to New York weight again.
I understand. All right. Well, with that, I want to thank you for coming onto the show today.
Thank you so much. This has been fun.
Yeah, I've been talking with Lincoln L. Hayes, and you can find, where can people find you online in your various projects?
You can find me across social media at Lincoln L. Hayes, Twitter and Instagram. I have a Facebook page, Lincoln L. Hayes Actor. I have a website, LincolnLHayes.com.
Your website has your YouTube videos of a lot of the stuff we talked about today on it.
I try to put everything there, so it's in one central place. PrettyBeardProductions.com for all the shorts and sketches that I do with the wife. Mm-hmm. And find everything you need at those places.
Well, thank you again. And thank you all for listening this week to Vermont Favorites. Take care. Talk to you soon.